Today is Veterans Day, a day when we honor and celebrate the service of all United States military veterans. In the next hour, you'll hear poetry and prose from local and area veterans sharing their experiences as members of the U.S. Armed Services. This is Veterans Reflections. I'm Hans Ahlstrom. Kaylin Bernard was a combat veteran in Iraq, serving in 2006 as MOS 92 Alpha, Automated Logistical Specialist. Her untitled story tells of her running in the 2013 Boston Marathon.
Our Waves countdown began as I looked at my new friend Chow. She was smiling and so was I. We counted together. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The third wave finally started. We were off, and there were so many people. Today I felt more than prepared. I felt honored. I was accepted for the April 15th, 2013 Boston Marathon event. Among other elite runners, I qualified and met the BAAA standards. After three attempts to shave off time, I was successful in Seattle, Washington on November 27th, 2011. I used that time of 3 hours, 31 minutes, and 35 seconds to run Boston 2013. A maximum of 27,000 runners in the whole world competing to run the 117th annual event. I decided to train back on the West Coast, fulfilling the challenge to run mountains instead of hills. In October of 2012, just a few months before Boston in April, I adventured to Hood River, Oregon. Its windful breeze and watered scenery, looking down from the canyon, had a sense of relaxation and peacefulness. I had a capacity of only 2,000 runners. This is my kind of race. It's such a beautiful place to run in the fall. The leaves large and full of color, falling as we ran. I knew that would help me for Heartbreak Hill at mile 22 in Boston, the most challenging hill on the course, and maybe of all marathons. So the morning of the Boston Marathon, I felt prepared but nervous. There would be more runners, and I felt the urgency to remind myself I'm safe and not back in Iraq, where my nightmares still haunt me of the war life I once had. I knew then it was 2013 and not 2006, when I'd returned from service. A sense of time was assuring me as I gazed at my Garmin watch on the bedstand that it was present. My mother had to remind me to remember my Garmin, which lets me know what my heart rate pace per mile at an important tool for a marathon runner. Mom reminded me again, this time of my socks. Kaylin, what socks are you going to wear? They're waiting downstairs. Yes, Mom, I got it, I said. I was getting flustered as I have troubles coming back to the present time. My mind tends to wander. Our friends from Argentina waited downstairs. We would all go to the start of the race. We were staying at the Westin in Waltham, Massachusetts, about 18 miles from downtown. So we needed to get there sooner to beat traffic. I contemplated what shoes to wear. My injured ankle needed the best support. I grabbed my shot block shoes and sunglasses and finished tying my Brooke Pier projects, much lighter than my old Ravana 3s, only broken in for a few hundred miles. I wore my Reebok Protective sleeve over the compression socks on my left ankle, giving it more support. I wanted to run and enjoy the feeling of being amongst the other runners and not think about my ankle. The bus ride smelled of bananas and Vaseline. It's such a strange combination of scents, but as you get to know the routine of a runner, it kind of makes sense. My friend and I talked about upcoming races. He asked me if I was going to run the New York Marathon. Maybe my half marathon time in Grand Rapids, 1 hour and 14 minutes, could qualify. I loved hearing his passion about running, his tips, how to overcome during obstacles, mental and physical. His personal best was 3 hours and 14 minutes, but today he wanted to break his personal record below 3 hours and 10 minutes. I just want to finish, I said. We got off the bus with half an hour to start time. There I met a woman in line, Marissa, from Appleton, Wisconsin, who ran Fox City's marathon, but more importantly, she had two rolls of toilet paper in her hand. I wasn't quite sure why until she said, "Do you need some? They're all out, but you can have some of mine." Yes. I could sense then that runners are a unique breed. There's something about us that brings a unity, and they know when to help one another. I thanked the woman and wished her luck. We were at the start of our wave, and the countdown began as I looked at my Garmin, which was ready at 000. We counted together, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The third wave, finally started. We were off. So many people. College students with Boston University sweatshirts, kids with bananas and oranges, people from all over the world watching us. France, Spain, Russia, they all watched at this moment. The large crowd made me nervous. I couldn't see all my surroundings, which is what veterans are trained to do. Not only see your surroundings, but know whether or not anything stands out, is out of the ordinary. I felt a small panic. I squeezed my shop blacks to remind me I was Boston. I remember what my mom had said. Chick, you made it this far. Just enjoy it. Embrace it. My dad sent me a text message. Good luck. Love you. All sorts of messages streamed in, and my music kept stopping from all the newsfeed of good luck. I ran and ran, quickened my pace, then slowed when needed. After mile 14, the crowd kept getting larger and larger, expanding in great numbers, lining the path. Heartbreak Hill came up fast. I made it. I called my mom and let her know where I was in case she was waiting for me at the finish, not to worry. She stood next to a blue mailbox on Boiler Street. Chick, I'm proud of you, she said. She moved away from her spot at the mailbox and toward the finish. A few minutes later, I thought I felt a concussion, like an IED in Iraq. That's when I knew something wasn't right. I was at mile 25.8 and was told to stop. I took off my headphones. Then, 30 seconds later, an explosion. It was loud. I could hear and feel the vibration going up my feet and into my ears. The streets became silent and everyone stopped. There's been an explosion, I heard someone yell. I knew that sound. I was back in Iraq. My year in combat trained me to fight, not flight. This experience too familiar. I took cover. I booked it out of there, grabbing female and male civilian runners with me, pulling them to safety. We were redirected by traffic. Most of the time, we wouldn't know where the motors came from. I moved quickly while others stood frozen in shock. My heart raced and sweat poured. Black smoke came from around the corner of Boiler Street. Paramedics rolled out stretchers. Firemen, even other veterans, helped keep things under control. I could smell burnt flesh and saw blown off limbs. The mixture of singed metal and blood scents brought me back to sitting as head gunner on a convoy's heavy artillery. I was better than most of the male soldiers in my platoon, so I had a lot of road time looking for Haji traps while riding on the Humvee turret at 60 miles per hour, the wind blasting my goggles, the horizon of threatening Iraq in front of me. But we were in a civilian world, in Boston. My two worlds had intersected, and I could not distinguish my past to my present. This was uncertainty, confusion. I had to be strong and take action like in combat. I led a group of civilians to evacuate immediately. It was said that there may have been more explosives in the place, ready to ruin the lives of others. All towers were shut down. I called my mother, but there was no answer. There was black smoke and blood on the streets. People everywhere panicked. There was the possibility more bombs set up in place, and it was coded to us that we needed to evacuate immediately. As a military veteran, I know protocol and procedure of evacuation and the importance of safety. Hundreds of runners and I evacuated, walking 10 blocks to Copley Square Park. We all waited. I called my mother's phone again. Nothing. An ambulance zoomed by, lights flashing, sirens on. The runners around me reconnected with their families. After 2 hours, my mother and I were able to reconnect to steps of a Catholic church. We hugged tightly. My mother sometimes would ask me about Iraq, but I couldn't explain until now through this embrace. I hugged her as if I just ended a long patrol in Baghdad. I told my mother, let's grab a cab and go back to our hotel. After we arrived at the hotel, we phoned family and loved ones.
Kaylin Bernard reading her story about taking part in the 2013 Boston Marathon. This is Veterans Reflections on Public Radio 90 WNMU and WNMUFM.org.
I know Martin Eden, gonna be proud of me now.
Michael Brennan was an aviation bosun's mate handler, third class, in the U.S. Navy from 2005 to 2009. He served on the USS Kitty Hawk and the USS Carl Vinson.
Singing my say, shiver me timbers, I'm a sailing away.
And a flag for Pearl. Haggard and faded from the rigors of flight operations and sluggishly making my way down to a hot shower in my bunk, I noticed the list posted on our division's office door declaring I would be manning the rails when we pulled into Pearl Harbor in the morning. I saw this coming, but didn't mind. My dress whites were still ironed and wrinkle-free from performing color guard in Malaysia, which is no simple feat since these uniforms always dirtied and stained very easily. and I really did enjoy the image of being dapperly dressed in my radiant whites, standing at attention on the edge of the flight deck while pulling into Pearl. It seemed like a fitting tribute for our shipmates who had just died. I just hoped I would be standing on the side of the ship with a view of the memorial. I headed down below decks and had a final cigarette for the evening, and stared into the sea, when an unfamiliar chief petty officer ruined my concentration as I stared out at the colossal and continuous cobalt blue seascape swirling below my steel-toed boots above the salt-stained and rusting haze-gray painted ship's hull. "Are you all right there, sailor?" he asked. "Are you thinking of back home, son?" "No, chief," I paused for a second before adding, "I am home." "Great answer, sailor. Great answer." When I awoke, I showered, shaved, and carefully put on my dress whites. I reported directly up on deck along with the other guys who were ordered to the side boy duty. My whites with their three green stripes and single row of medals were flawless. I luckily enough was able to get a decent spot standing on the starboard side up on the bow. I was able to see the Arizona as we pulled in, and the ship's whistle sounded the exact moment we passed her to salute the several sunken ships and entombed sailors of Pearl. We pulled in much slower than usual into the infamous waterfront, and I was absolutely overtaken by a morose tingling in the spine, complete with soulful empathy for all those fallen fathoms beneath the sea. I couldn't stop thinking about how many sailors were still underneath the blue-green water within those twisted steel coffins that began a world war in an atomic age. I had thought of Pearl Harbor often when we were home and docked in Yokosuka, Japan, which is actually where all the carriers were deployed from to wake up America that fateful morning. I often wondered how all the sailors felt on December 7th, 1941, being hung over from their Saturday night out and wishing they weren't stuck on duty that day when planes appeared out of nowhere and began bombing them relentlessly. It was a thought I often had when I had imbibed a bit too much and was sleeping in on a Sunday morning. Would I have ever acted as heroically as they had on that day, destined to live on in infamy? Here I was taking in the scene of the surprise attack firsthand. I had never felt this much pride to be a U.S. sailor, if only for their memory, but not so much for my current enlistment. I could only make out the rusting smokestack of the Arizona besides the large white memorial created around it to memorialize the wreck. The rumor often repeated was that traces of oil still spilled out of the wreckage were the tears of all the sailors that were still entombed within. I had wondered so many times what would happen if there was a sudden raid on us, or what if we were bombed by radicals like the USS Cole in Yemen. It was always possible, especially when we're docked somewhere like Malaysia or drifting too close to North Korea, and especially during a time when the enemy doesn't wear an identifiable uniform while fighting on a carefully drawn battlefield. There was always plenty of anti-American groups in Japan, and any time a vehicle came on base, including the taxis I often took, they were subjected to searches by metal detectors at the front gate. The threat ran internally as well. What would I do if a sailor on board snapped and went on a murderous rampage? There had been a few threatened murders and suicides on board involving unbalanced and on a few occasions 9mm toting personnel. There was even a notable race riot on the ship in the early 70s. It would not be difficult to picture the carrier turning into the setting of a massacre, considering the treatment and mental stability of some of the sailors. And although this was before the Fort Hood shooting, I was always convinced that at any time the opening half of Full Metal Jacket could happen. The ship's whistle blew and everyone manning the rails on both sides of the ship saluted while the national anthem played robustly as we passed by the ruins of a once fierce naval fleet. It was the most eerie graveyard I had ever been in, and I held my salute until my right arm went numb and my body was fixed at strict military attention with all the somber pride I could muster. The guys lost down in the Pacific just a few feet below me probably were younger than I was, less confused maybe, and certainly more patriotic, and were more likely better men than I could ever dream of being. I almost felt ashamed to share their same uniform. It was a scene I knew I could never forget. It was the only time I was sure of who and what I was. For once, I felt like I found something resembling identity. I could now live for those hushed heroic ghosts rather than constantly considering the mindless mishaps and dim-witted faults of my pathetic, lethargic life. I wished I could prove myself in a test of life and death, but instead these instances all just happened around me, and I was never invited in to take the exam. I was just idly waiting in the wings for a single shot at not necessarily greatness, but of obtaining some sort of resilient self-worth and satisfaction. The next week I had duty and was assigned to perform color guard. I was awfully hungover from the past day's liberty, and grabbed the American flag and the Union Jack and headed up topside when the whistles announced, first call to colors. The ritual had just begun when I truly realized it was the 4th of July, and I was raising the American flag right across from the Arizona. An overwhelming sense of sadness swept over me as I struggled to keep my composure. I couldn't think of any joyful thoughts while standing in an infamous cemetery in the middle of a tourist paradise, and all I could do was focus on my task at hand with every ounce of might I could muster this morning. I had performed colors too many times to count, but this was proving both excruciating and exhausting. I made all my movements and hand salutes snap as a solid example of military bearing as I saw the small tour boats leading out to the wreck site for their memorial visit, and wanted to provide a solid show for both the living and the ghosts that lay below. My problems were ridiculous compared to those of the past. When we finished, I went into flight deck control and vomited in the adjacent head. When the sun started to set, I would have to do this all over again. The rest of the day I napped and recovered from my past couple days' debauchery, ate meals while hoping our deceased shipmates in the mess deck freezers had been shipped home, and only went down below to smoke cigarettes. It was obnoxious seeing large groups of the crew leaving for 4th of July parties while we were stuck on board, but I had my share of entertainment for the past few nights, and once everyone had cleared out, it seemed like the rest of us just grew solemn and silent. I just walked through the day on autopilot, and the hours just passed by with everyone preparing to stand watches or coming back and changing into different uniforms. At 5:45 p.m., I carefully put my whites back on and went back up to lower the flags. When colors were called, we formed ourselves in position and marched towards the flag's jackstaffs, both forward and aft. I was trying hard to concentrate on my duties, but people were taking pictures of us from both onboard the ship and from the shore. I focused on my movements as the flash of cameras flickered directly at us. Taps played, and I popped a perfect salute after slowly lowering the national ensign into the crook of my left arm. The sounds of fireworks almost drowned out the trumpet notes, but I refused to be distracted and held my position that was obviously on display. My eyes watered against my will. Luckily, no one was close enough to capture my tears for posterity. My pride was indescribable. Words couldn't capture my full range of emotions. I was worshipping an America that most likely no longer and could no longer exist. Was there still an American dream? I desperately hoped so. I was doing this in her honor and memory, and for all those who came before me. I was fully in the moment and ignored my damp cheeks and burning eyes. My buddy Carol was beside me but didn't say anything. I was sure he was feeling all of this in his own private way. The ceremony felt like forever but was over in mere minutes. When we had finished, I was so exhausted, I immediately hit my bunk. I didn't dream. Even the returning drunks couldn't wake me up.
Michael Brennan, reading an excerpt from his story, A Flag for Pearl, from his novel, Drunk on the Foam. You're listening to Veterans Reflections on Public Radio 90 and WNMUFM.org. Michael Greer was a Sergeant E5 in the U.S. Army 2nd Battalion 59th. He served from September 1969 to August 1971.
There must be some kind of way out of here, said a joker to the thief. There's too much confusion.
Sergeant, holy crap, Bradford got hit by lightning. Calm down, soldier. Who is this? Identify yourself. Due to my unusual status as Sergeant E5, the chevron with the three pairs of stripes, a designation which we were told the Army was phasing out in favor of Specialist E5, my leadership skills were often called upon to do regular duty, like guarding the nearby missile silos a mile from camp. Actually, Spec 5s were doing this duty too, so I really only had to pull Sergeant of the Guard about once a month. Sergeants were supposed to be used when leading troops, and this particular guard duty, we had with me 8 men at 4 corners stations around 16 abandoned missile silos, all behind a 20-foot-high fence. There hadn't been any missiles in the silos for some time, maybe since the end of the Cold War. We were in Germany. Wars were over in Europe, while Vietnam carried on. No missiles, but perhaps 1,000 gallons of olive drab paint were at stake. Flammable, they needed to be in a secure place as well. Why not guard it against theft and possible sabotage and exercise the troops at the same time? Olive drab wasn't a popular color, but we guarded against our own army stealing it. It was busy work, for our battalion had no real duties yet. This one particular night in Schwabach, Germany, there was a very nasty thunderstorm going on. Lightning, thunder, rain. And it was my duty to stay awake at the radio at the barracks command center. Also, I was to wake up the next 4 guards and drive them out in a jeep to replace the 4 already guarding the paint. I had an assistant, a PFC, who would wake me if I fell asleep. If he too fell asleep, the guard situation would deteriorate, the paint would be compromised, the free world would collapse. Guard duty, a 24-hour assignment with 4 hours sleep shifts, then 4 hours on duty. Sometimes it was difficult to catch enough sleep, and guards continued it at their stations. The missile silo facility was 16 giant mounds in a square fenced-in field. Each corner mound had a small wooden shack placed on top, very similar to an outhouse. They were 4 foot by 4 foot square, with large windows on every side. The windows protected us from the elements, and in summer, screens replaced the windows. A small kerosene heater was supplied in winter. The guard's job was to keep it full of kerosene, stored in the same bunker nearest them with the paint. Each guard was supplied with an M16 already assigned to them, plus a handheld radio phone for answering calls each hour of their duty. Men would bring snacks, a book to read by flashlight, maybe a pocket radio with earphone. No MP3 players back then. Each man had an armband like the military police, MP, but with the letters GD for guard duty. Mine was SG for Sergeant of the Guard, and I had my usual .45 caliber pistol at my side, complete with empty clip. I was a conscientious objector, after all. As everyone in the battalion pulled guard duty, even most officers, the whole thing ran smoothly and efficiently from the day we arrived as a 500-man battalion in the fall of 1970. But on this particular night, with rains blowing in extreme up to 50 miles an hour, temperatures still springtime in the high 30s, things were anything but all right. It was about 2 a.m., only 6 hours from the end of our 24-hour shift, when a new crew would take over. The thunder followed a bright flash of cloud-to-ground lightning by only seconds. It was getting closer. Then the frantic call came over the radio. Sergeant! Sergeant! Holy crap! Bradford got hit by lightning! Calm down, soldier. Who is this? Identify yourself. The soldier gave his name and shack. Singleton, Guard Shack 4. Close enough to witness what happened in Guard Shack 3. Apparently Bradford couldn't be seen in the guard shack just before the strike, as he was probably sitting on the floor sleeping. When the lightning hit the shack, it exploded outward, sending all the lumber in every direction as if a bomb had hit it. Singleton couldn't see if Bradford was lying in the debris or not. I suggested he go over into Shack 3 and see if he could find Bradford and see if he was all right. I suggested, too, that if he wasn't breathing, he should attempt CPR on him. I would be there shortly. Bradford was already known as Mr. Lucky. Upon entering the service, Army dentists decided he had a rare gum disease, so they pulled all of his beautiful teeth, every one. It took 6 months for his new dentures to catch up to him in Germany. We all went out to celebrate his new teeth. On our way home, we crossed a bridge in downtown Nuremberg. Bradford felt sick and threw up over the rail of the bridge, losing his dinner. And, of course, his new dentures. Same day he got them. Upon reevaluation, it was determined that he did not have a gum disease after all. He was no Mr. Lucky. I called for an ambulance from Frankfurt, knowing that they would be more than 45 minutes getting to us. I grabbed my raincoat, a handset, and a large 4-cell flashlight. My PFC stayed behind to receive any calls from Frankfurt, and I left him the task of waking up the officer of the guard, which that night was my commo captain, Captain Hirsch. I never knew what OGs did after a phone call, but was glad to see my captain from my day job as radio teletype team chief. I liked him, trusted him, and respected his judgment. He arrived at the guard shack shortly after I did. When I arrived, Singleton was standing next to the now-seated Bradford. He was apparently okay, even as smoke rose from his body. He didn't remember what happened to him, and he was more than a bit dazed. Upon inspection of the debris, the biggest remaining piece of lumber was about 2 inches, spread out in a 50-foot radius. We could tell that he had been sitting on the floor of the shack, his rifle now 10 feet away. He no longer wore his helmet, which was about 20 feet away, a giant 6-inch hole in the top. The captain and I determined the lightning had struck the shack, hit the rifle, bounced to the helmet, exploded it off Bradford's head, the current then running through his body, escaping out his right foot to the ground. The sole of his right boot was gone. A little melted sole left on the boot, still smoking. Yes, it was a steel-reinforced boot like Rangers wore, actually against regs in our camp. We found the sole nearby. There was something odd about Bradford's look. And the captain, myself, and Singleton all realized together what was different. Every tiny speck of hair on his head was burnt to the skin. Even his eyebrows and lashes were gone. The skin on his head was covered with second and third degree burns, making it almost look like he had hair. The hair in his nose was singed, as he could smell his own burnt hair and skin. Same, too, on the bottom of his right foot, all the skin covered in burns, and actually still steaming. Probably from the burnt leather. M-16s, the guards carried, were required to have their bayonets attached during guard duty. Bradford's was split down the middle of the entire blade. The plastic handguard used to hold the rifle with the left hand was half-melted. Surely the path of the lightning. Bradford was thrown out of the shack with the explosion. He would remember bits later, but his being asleep and sitting down probably saved his life. PFC Bradford was 19 years old. He was hospitalized for a short time while his skin grew back on the bottom of his foot. He was sent stateside. As a draftee, his tour was over. They gave him some money, too, compensating his pain. The Army was at fault here, rather nature, and we all missed him. Each guard shack should have been supplied with a lightning rod, an external ground that ran deep enough into the ground to absorb any size lightning. This would happen, and also the use of plastic rifles with ceramic barrels, something that was experimental but appropriate for trial on our mounds. Viewed as a training exercise, our guard duty eventually was curtailed and the paint stored at each individual military installation instead of one big pile. This all happened after I left Germany and the Army 3 weeks later.
Michael Greer, reading his story Bradford and the Bolt. You're listening to Veterans Reflections on Public Radio 90, WNMU, and WNMUFM.org.
Well, I woke up Sunday morning with no way to hold my head. That didn't hurt.
Gabe Waskowitz's father, Michael Joseph Waskowitz, served in the Army in Vietnam and received an honorable discharge.
For dessert.
Sunday morning, coming down. On a cloudy day in late August, just before the start of my fourth year of college, I sat alone doing my daily afternoon bong tokes when someone knocked on my door. Come on, I bellowed. This was my customary greeting. Looking back, it probably sounded more like hold on, but at the time I was too burnt out to realize this or just about anything else. Most of my friends usually just walked in after a quick knock, so I was a bit tentative while I maneuvered through my hazy apartment towards the front door. Still, I didn't bother to hide the bong or the Tupperware container filled with crystal-coated buds. I said, come in, I muttered, as I swung the door open. On the other side stood two Michigan State police troopers, both wearing matching looks of gloom. My initial paranoia turned to outright fear when the older of the two officers asked, may I speak with Gabriel Waskowitz? What had I done? Well, actually, what hadn't I done lately to warrant a visit from the cops? The last couple years of my life had consisted of one long series of drug-induced adventures. But what did they know about? Should I lie? Tell them, he's not here right now, and hope for the best? After glancing over my shoulder at the swirls of pot smoke glimmering in the patch of daylight, the open door allowed into my otherwise dreary abode, I felt less than reassured. The marching hammers on the Pink Floyd the Wall poster hanging behind my TV set didn't help. Yeah, that's me, I finally whimpered. I've always been too dumb to lie. You're the son of Michael Joseph Waskowitz? Yes, sir. I'm sorry to have to inform you, the officer said while struggling to maintain eye contact, but your father was found dead this morning. A few more questions passed between us. How did it happen? Where was he found? Is there anything else we can do for you? But the rest of that day has faded into the fog of my living room. At some point, I called my only sibling, my sister Catherine. I must have called my mom, too. I'm sure I did more bong tokes. I know I didn't cry. I first remember seeing my father when I was around 5 or 6. Faded Polaroids are evidence of previous encounters, but I have no recollection of the awkward moments that they capture of Catherine and me sitting on my father's lap. In each photo, he tried to maintain a smile. Despite the circumstances and the looks of terror on his children's faces, my father's bright blue eyes gleam in stark contrast to his white t-shirt and the cement walls in the background. Those moments of uncomfortable hugs and forced kisses are not what I recall most about this day either. My first experience with Chicken McNuggets on the way there, and my repeated attempts to get my stepdad to come inside linger instead. But why do you want to come inside with us, Jim? I pestered my stepdad in the waiting area, failing to fully comprehend the situation. My mother had remarried shortly before I turned 5, and with a male figure finally in my life, I wanted him to accompany me everywhere. I just really don't like these kind of places, he said, gently trying to appease me. It'll be okay. You go on in with your mom and sis, and I'll be right here waiting when you get back. But why don't you like it here? I just don't like being frisked, he finally grumbled. Still not completely convinced, I continued pleading with him as a short, squat female guard patted me down and ushered me through a metal detector. I followed her, mesmerized by the huge ring of keys hanging at her side. They jangled like my mom's wind chimes as she led us through a series of locked doors and ushered us into the visitation area of the Marquette Maximum Security Prison. One rainy summer afternoon a couple of years later, I discovered several handwritten pages tucked away in a dusty Bible on my mom's bookshelf. At first, I half-skimmed the writing before realizing what it contained. I became mesmerized, not really wanting to read these words to know what my dad had done to my mom, but I was unable to stop. This letter was my mom's account of the night my dad nearly killed her, written as a form of therapy. Before finding it, I knew little about my father's imprisonment, only that he had somehow hurt my mother. The letter vividly described how in the midst of a Vietnam flashback, he repeatedly choked her to the point of passing out. While I cried in my crib at 9 months old, my father was out of his mind trying to strangle my mom. Upon regaining consciousness, she tried pleading with him to let her check on the baby, to which he responded, I'll take care of him when I'm finished with you. Eventually, my mom managed to escape outside long enough to alert the neighbors to call the police. before being dragged back inside. I placed the letter back in the Bible as raindrops trickled down our living room window. I never talked about the letter or what it contained with anyone. Only years later did my mom explain to me more about what happened that night. My father had once again started to slowly lose his grip on reality. He had been attending Alcoholics Anonymous and claimed that they had told him to stop taking the medications prescribed to him for the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder because he was using them as a substitute for alcohol. He became increasingly angry and paranoid. He thought the meter reader for the electric company was at the house because my mother was having an affair with him. He accused her of trying to poison his food. Everything became her fault. Unable to cope without his medication, my father eventually lost control completely. Earlier that day, his best friend since childhood, Mark, came to the house with the hopes of getting my mom to go and stay with his wife and him for a while. Being a Vietnam vet too, Mark understood some of what my father was experiencing. My mom told Mark that she'd married my father for better or for worse. He was sentenced to serve 3 to 10 years for intent to do great bodily harm. My mom filed for divorce and brought me and my sister back to live in the small northern Michigan town where she had grown up. At 19, my father volunteered for the Army, assuming he would be drafted and sent to Vietnam anyway. He always kept his experiences there private, telling me only that they weren't women and baby killers, and to believe parts of Full Metal Jacket and the Deer Hunter more than Apocalypse Now. From what I've been told, on his 25th birthday, which fell on or near Mother's Day, he watched his whole platoon die around him. Somehow he survived untouched, at least physically. He suffered a complete nervous breakdown. After a medevac flew him out of the jungle, my father was sent back to the States, first to a veterans hospital in San Diego, and then to another hospital in his home state of Michigan. These would be the first in a series of VA hospitalizations that would plague him for the rest of his life. While I was growing up, he often asked me, "Is it better to live a coward or die a hero?" I would not be here had he died a hero. Maybe he would not have suffered for the remainder of his life if he had not thought of himself as a coward. Once my father was released from prison, he made an effort to make up for the years he had missed. My first memory of seeing him outside of the penitentiary was in a cafe called the Night Owl in my hometown. As we sat in a booth eating breakfast with my maternal grandmother, I couldn't help but gawk at this loud, socially awkward creature sitting across from me. He'd holler for the waitress to bring him more coffee between bites of overly peppered eggs. His booming voice carried throughout the small restaurant, drawing looks from other customers. Looking back, the small-town rumors about who he was and where he'd just gotten out of probably had as much to do with the odd looks he received as his eccentric behavior did. But a child of 8 fails to draw such conclusions. As we ate, he asked me questions about what I wanted to be when I grew up and what I was learning in school. I did my best to answer him, but could only squeak out a few half-hearted responses as I scooted closer to my grandma. Later, when he got up to use the bathroom, I asked my grandma, "Is this really my real dad?" He had just bought me every G.I. Joe guy I wanted in the Ben Franklin next door, but I was having trouble accepting that the man everyone seemed to be staring at could in any way be responsible for me. He seemed so foreign to the world I was accustomed to. All my grandma could do was sigh and slowly nod her head. I would continue to be embarrassed by my father throughout my adolescence. In fact, for the remainder of his life, I felt varying degrees of discomfort when dealing with my father in public. Some of this embarrassment was caused by his drinking. Preferring brandy and blads over prescription medication, he'd tell me that every town needs a drunk. Having never experienced any form of alcoholism when I was younger, trying to understand and cope with this for my father was difficult. Being on 100% disability from the military, he wasn't your typical town drunk, waking up in gutters and begging for change. He had enough money to support himself, but maintained the life of a daily alcoholic, spending many lonely hours deep inside a bottle. Accepting him for who he was would take me many years. As these years went by, my father spent less time in the city of Saginaw where he grew up, and more time in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, just to be close to my sister and me. It began as visits for a few days or a week, time we'd spend in his hotel room watching old films like Dr. Zhivago. My mom, who always wanted her children to know their father, eventually allowed him to visit us at our home in the country. On one such visit, I was outside playing with my father and a foster child who lived with my family when a helicopter approached. Whatever game we were playing ceased to have meaning as my father crouched down in the tall weeds, imploring us to do the same. As I tried to explain that the other boy's name was Ronnie, not Charlie, my father became increasingly frantic. Once the hiss of the propeller faded into the distance, he slowly started to regain his composure. Ronnie and I couldn't understand why he didn't want to stay outside and play anymore. These short stays eventually led to him renting a cabin for the summer. Then he rented an apartment for a year, about an hour away, just on the other side of the Wisconsin border. Finally, for a majority of my last couple years of high school, he lived in or around my hometown. During this ever-increasing time spent with him, I learned more about the person he was and who he could have been. When I was old enough to drive, I'd usually stop in for a visit a couple times a week. He'd cook me a steak and ask me what I wanted to be when I grew up. We'd watch a baseball game, and he'd tell me he would have enjoyed watching me play Little League more than these overpriced bastards on TV. One night, I was just getting ready to leave, to go drink some beers with friends, most likely, when the John Malkovich version of Mice and Men came on TV. When I explained to him that I'd read The Grapes of Wrath in school instead, and by read, I mean mostly slept through the movie, he refused to let me leave. Usually when I wanted to go, he tried to get me to stay a little longer, but that night he basically forced me to stay. The memory of watching the tale of George and Lenny that night with my father is far better than whatever drunken adventures I would have gotten into with my buddies. In the same one-bedroom home where he first introduced me to the power of Steinbeck, we also pondered the fate of the world as we watched O.J. fleeing in his white Bronco. It was the day after my 18th birthday. Another time, I sat in awe as he answered nearly every question in an episode of Jeopardy correctly through a mouthful of spaghetti, chunks of noodles flying at Alex Trebek's face on the TV screen. We even got a chance to drink a few beers together some nights the summer after my senior year, and he would give me advice like, never trust a man who won't have a drink with you. I didn't realize then that I was a lot more like him than I would ever care to admit. I began to understand that despite all his imperfections, he cared more about Catherine and me than anything. When he was around my friends, I was still mortified at what he might say or do. I never got to the point where I felt completely comfortable with him around other people. If it was just the two of us, I accepted him for who he was, but around others, I was still somewhat ashamed that he was my father. Still, it was during these years that I started to consider him more than just a father. He was my dad. This process never fully blossomed, however. He would die before I could ever fully come to appreciate him. The frequent conclusions to most of his visits or stays in the UP was often a trip to the VA hospital. Ever since Vietnam, he suffered from bouts of mental illness. Diagnosed as both schizophrenic and bipolar, he functioned normally for long stretches of time, only to inevitably lose touch once again. While in the hospital, he would call regularly, feeding quarters into a payphone just to hear his kids' voices. Long letters would arrive in the mail nearly every other day. They were often hard to read because his already scribbled handwriting became nearly illegible from over-medication. I still have one of the last letters he sent me. In it, he candidly describes how he blamed himself more than circumstance for the events of his life. Also included are regrets about not being around when I was little, the usual demand that I never join the military, a recommendation of Hemingway and Steinbeck because they knew the score, and most of the lyrics to Johnny Cash's Sunday Morning Coming Down. In the song, Cash begins, "Well, I woke up Sunday morning with no way to hold my head that didn't hurt, and the beer I had for breakfast wasn't bad, so I had one more for dessert. Then I fumbled in my closet, threw my clothes to find my cleanest dirty shirt." My dad acknowledged that these words were not his own, but he felt that they probably best described his life. The chorus ends with a line, and it took me back to something that I'd lost somewhere, somehow, along the way. The last time I saw my dad alive was at my cousin Rachel's wedding. He looked good, thinner than I'd seen him in years. He looked so happy as he danced with my sister, slowly swaying to the music. After dinner and a couple of beers, he left early, having said goodbye to everyone. Only 2 weeks later, he was found in a bed at a Super 8 near Saginaw by the maid. Gastrointestinal hemorrhage, a common problem with alcoholics. The warning signs of internal bleeding ignored, he basically bled to death internally. My dad was 49. The tears that didn't come the day I found out he died also didn't come at his funeral. Instead, I remained stoic as Mark, his childhood friend, looked into the casket and said, "Mike's finally come home from Vietnam." Like many men from his generation, my father could never put the horrors of the war behind him. What happened to him there came to define the rest of his life. When he died, I don't think I knew how to feel about my father yet. I feared being like him for so long that I wasn't prepared to properly let him go. Now, a decade and a half later, I've accepted him for who he was. A kind, compassionate man, flawed like everyone else, some of which was his own doing, and some of which was not. In the years since his death, I've had my own struggles with drugs and alcohol, battled bouts of mental illness, and through it all, learned that being like your father isn't always the worst thing in the world. A year after his death, I went to his grave with a six-pack of Heineken and started the path towards acceptance. As I sat and shared those beers with my dad, I told him all the things I was too immature to say when he was alive. Things like, I forgive you for everything. I wish I understood you more when you were alive. I know you loved my mom until the day you died. And I know your suffering is finally over. Maybe these are the things I said then, or maybe they're just the things I think of now that I wish I had said sooner.
Gabe Waskowitz, reading his story, Sunday Morning Coming Down. You're listening to Veterans Reflections on Public Radio 90, WNMU. Milton Bates served as a sergeant in the Army from 1970 to 1971 during the Vietnam War.
Football in July, 1970. You could count on it. The game would be brutal when they showed up red-eyed from lack of sleep, wearing the welts of a night among mosquitoes in a piss-fouled bunker. The longer the mortars fell, the more intense the play. The wind peppered their faces with dust as they piled fatigue jackets for boundaries on a godforsaken slab of clay. After the coin toss, it was skins against t-shirts, both sides in olive drab from belt to jungle boots. No anthem or referees, no spectators besides the guys in the guard tower, weary of watching concertina wire. They played two-hand touch, not tackle, but ferocious, dirty, elbows to ribs and knees to groins. How good it felt to see the enemy and know the score. They played to hurt. They played to win. Mantra. There it is, they said, and meant it, when there was nothing else to say about the village vaporized by a misplaced bomb, the patrol shredded by artillery support, the short-timer wasted by a booby trap. There it was when a letter from home said there was no home to return to, when a platoon went over the edge, shooting chickens and children. There it was whenever logic failed or justice. You could ask about the whereness of there, or the whatness of it, but not about the pure ontology of is. Is refused to answer questions. Syllables so often in their mouths grew smooth and egg-shaped, like the pebbles along the South China Sea. They chose streaked or speckled ones, rinsed off the sand, and put them in their pockets for good luck.
Milton Bates, reading his poems Football in July, 1970, and Mantra. You're listening to Veterans Reflections on Public Radio 90, WNMU, and WNMUFM.org. I see the bad moon rising. Tony Williams was a buck sergeant in the Army's 145th Combat Aviation Battalion in Vietnam from 1967 to 1970. He also served in the National Guard from 1984 to 1988.
Surreal Sabbath. Palm trees, shrubs, rice paddies, and man-made structures dashed 100 feet beneath us in a blur. As we banked out over the winding, muddy waters of the Da Nang River, our shadows passed over perplexed, startled, upward-looking faces from sampans, klong houses, and floating markets. This wasn't some trendy helicopter Southeast Asian eco-tour. It was my 23rd daytime combat assault mission, and we are the 118th Assault Helicopter Company, also known as the Bandits Platoon. I was a UH-1C Huey gunship helicopter left door gunner with an M60 machine gun lying heavily on my lap. I was in the number two ship of a three-ship heavily armed and overloaded Huey helicopter gunship convoy lumbering into the Sunday morning sky out over Benoit, Vietnam. We were headed to a rendezvous point about 50 clicks to the southeast to escort a dozen Huey troop-carrying helicopters, or SLICs, to an LZ. So that meant I have about 30 minutes of flight time to take care of gunnery duties, watch out for hostile fire, and enjoy the unfolding drama below. We flew NOE, or a nap of the earth, or just above the treetops and sometimes between them this morning at about 90 miles an hour, since it was harder for the enemy to shoot us down at high speed. Plus, it was so much more fun. And sometimes I would look for the beauty or mystery of Nam. So as we banked out over the mystique of the sinuous Da Nang River, leaving behind us flying toward the rising sun, it felt as if we had entered what seemed like another world or a parallel universe, shrouded by taboo and the dragon's breath below. The ground fog was one more thing that obscured Charlie, who lived down there and who wanted to keep it that way. The true knowledge of awesomeness, fear, love, and uncertainty was everywhere. I also felt fragility and lethality at the same time. We could be knocked out of the sky with some well-placed VC anti-aircraft fire. And at the same time, we had enough ordnance to completely kill and obliterate three city blocks. During times like this, flying over the jungle, I would switch from warrior to one who admires, absorbs, and imbibes the wonders of this Asian paradise caught in a state of unstable flux. Up ahead, I saw the bright orange terracotta roofs of an opulent French rubber plantation. Its clean, well-maintained grounds accentuated the cultural contrast in another conquered symbol from the past. The bright blue swimming pool persistently showed off its majesty in the face of a war-torn nation. It was our American oversexed, overpowered, and over-here hedonistic eyes, though, that plied the pool's edge for the occasional beautiful, scantily clad French-Vietnamese woman of Da Nang, sunbathing on the pool edge. We left the plantation mansion behind, and up ahead, the jungle opened up into a square-mile series of rice paddies. On the south edge lay an apparent peaceful and pastoral village. In it, families were going about their agrarian lifestyle as they have for perhaps hundreds or even thousands of years. A water buffalo pulled a plow led by a young Vietnamese Boi San in soiled khaki shorts and white shirts. As we approached, snowy egrets elegantly took to the wing in apparent slow motion to escape the menacing noise of our helicopter and the threat of us. All is friendly here until nightfall, when Charlie and the NVA seethed into the shadows and took back its turf in the minds of the simple people trying to scratch out an existence. Soon, Buddha Mountain proudly thrusted upward from the surrounding flat, lush green and brown landscape below. Our three-ship gunship helicopters in trail formation flew alongside the rocky escarpment that had been shrouded in mysticism and wonder until the last decade, when this most recent war kicked off. As we traveled further, we saw a Buddhist temple precariously poised on a rocky escarpment precipice. Mosaic dragons decorating its pillars seemed to beckon, "Come no closer." The bright reds, yellows, and blues of the temple, Buddha statues, monk robes, and prayer flags were a striking contrast to the greens and browns of most of Vietnam. Exotic plants clung to the rocky escarpments, while long vines dangled for 100 feet or more, disappearing into the dragon's breath below, covering the jungle floor. In moments like this, I imagine we were in a National Geographic travelogue, sent to explore the unknown spiritual treasures and vistas of Southeast Asia. The serene experience was soon interrupted by the crackle of the VHF radio wired into my flight helmet. Being immediately drawn back into the military Indochina reality from my surreal inner reality, I paid attention to the succinct monotone of Major Moody, the CO and today's flight leader of the 190th Raiders. It was hard, though, since I always had to fight back a smirk when I heard the name Major Moody. The Moody Blues had recently stormed the music world with their psychedelic music of the late 60s. To add to the hilarity, the Raiders icon, or nose art, emblazoned on the aircraft was Yosemite Sam, with both pistols drawn and wild-eyed look of, "Bring 'em on, partner." This major had his own moods, and they weren't serenading blues. It was more of a 1-2 punch to Charlie's gut. How does one transition their mind amidst all this? How does one go from a peaceful American civilization just 2 years ago to an unwilling soldier not only being comfortable in a war-torn country, to actually desiring it? How does one become at ease with the possibility that a misstep could lead to loss of limb, or a integral part of the chopper falling off and resulting in all on board plummeting to the earth like a mortally wounded bird? The choices appear clear after a while. Become captivated in fear 24/7 or embrace it. Some would live in a bottle, high, or absorbed in a sense of security religion plays. Others were just tough guys that thumbed their noses at death. I wasn't one of those. I suppose it was different with everyone. With flight crews, pilots, door gunners, and CIA observers that we took up, there was a commonality, a need to fly and maintain the high ground below us. Meanwhile, the Vietnamese struggled in their mute nostril agony, as the doors might have said. We, on the other hand, experienced America's first rock and roll war.
Tony Williams, reading his story, Surreal Sabbath. You're listening to Veterans Reflections on Public Radio 90 WNMU and WNMUFM.org. Alan Lurst was an E-4 in the Army with the 101st Air Mobile in Vietnam from 1969 to 1971.
Snakes and Dragons. If you ask me what I remember, I will tell you this. I was a boy in Vietnam. My name is Tim Tran. The place of my employment, Detroit Linen and Uniform Service, is where they call me Little Buddy. I do not like the name, but what does it matter? It is only a name. My real name is Tran Dan Tu. My father called me TT. My mother gave me this name because she said Tu means autumn in Vietnamese. And a Vietnam autumn, when the rains come, washes everything clean. It is a new beginning, too, my mother told me. Each time you are reborn. My mother was a poor woman, never married. She did laundry for North Vietnamese soldiers after they liberated Saigon. Today it is called Ho Chi Minh City, and that is where she died with cancer in her lungs. Her name was Mai. I think about my mother each day as I load dirty hospital and hotel linen into a conveyor belt and dump it into giant sterilization vats. I set the locks. All computerized now. I do not think about filth and disease. I watch steam rise to fluorescent lights. It reminds me of Vietnam when sweat runs down my body inside my Detroit Linen Service uniform. I look good in the uniform, I think. The sun in Detroit, during late July, hides behind skyscrapers and raindrops linger in the air, but I cannot see them. They call this humidity. Water in the air. The few whites working at Detroit Linen and Uniform Service drive the big white trucks. Little buddy, the whites say, you got that laundry ready for the skipper? Then they laugh. I do not understand the reference. though I know it is from an old TV program, and I laugh too. I try to fit in. Since I am 32 years and still a bachelor, I change clothes in the locker room and leave work. I go to a strip club called the Gold Monkey on Mack Avenue. It is the oldest in Detroit. I go there because my father talked about it, about the beautiful women. But what I see are clownish, half-naked women dancing around a smudged pole. They do not show us their real faces. I go there because I am waiting for a sign. I give money to the women, slip a dollar bill here and a dollar bill there into their underwear. They dance in front of me for a while and then move to another table, where other men wait with fistfuls of dollar bills. I do not drink much beer because it costs $8. The rock and roll music reminds me of my father, reminds me my father was black. I listen to the music and think about why the Americans abandoned us in South Vietnam and took my father with them. What choice did he have? For almost 2 years we were a family. My mother had told me this, said he was a soldier stationed at Camp Sally near Phu Bai. She told me he was a professional boxer and called away to box in places like Thailand and Japan. The commanders bet money on him and won. Maybe this is why I like to gamble. When I ask my mother to tell me more, she refuses, says, "Forget about him. He is a ghost." But I somehow knew he chose to fight with his fist so he did not have to kill Vietnamese people. "Why a ghost?" I once asked my mother. "Bring in the wood," she say. "Build a fire." Because I am Bao Dai, a child of dust, I was invisible and different from other children. Yet I knew there is I separate from we. I do not mind it now, but as a child they called me names. The other children said my nose was too broad and flat, my skin too dark, not a pretty yellow like theirs. They said I looked like an animal, a monkey. They said my spirit would not find rest. In Vietnam, there are monkey bridges made of bamboo the people cross single file. I am crossing a bridge too, alone, but it is in my mind, and you cannot see it. My mother said children were cruel, to pay them no attention. "Ignore them," she said. "Tomorrow you will be different than you are today." If I stare long enough at the darkened stage, light spinning blue and green, the room becomes liquid with my father walking toward me. He is wearing boxing trunks, embroidered with snakes and dragons. His eyes look into mine, but I am not an opponent. I am not the enemy. He is a black man with strong arms and legs, a powerful chest. I feel his warm palms against my small hands. I am a child he scoops up and holds. I smell sea salt, the South China Sea, and his sweat from hitting a bag hung on the branch of a jambu tree. He is a good smell. I burrow my head into his chest. This is my father. He will protect me. He floats in the room, magically appears here and there in flashing strobe lights. It's as if I am dancing with my father, but then he lets me go, and I am lost in gunfire pounding from speakers. My father is a strong man, but he cannot hold me. For a moment, I am afraid until I hear my father's voice. "Don't worry, little TT. I will teach you to box. Your mother will sew dragons and snakes on your robe." Somewhere in my peripheral vision, I see my mother nodding. "Learn to defend," my father says. His eyes are darker than betel nut. I stare back. "Yes, father, I will," I say.
Alan Lurst, reading his story Snakes and Dragons. The story appears in his book Dancing at the Golden Monkey from Leapfrog Press. Alex Gubbins served as sergeant in the U.S. Army Reserve from 2000 to 2008. He was deployed to the war in Iraq from 2004 to 2005, where he served as an Army enlisted counselor.
In the Blood. I thought it best to measure the year I was gone by how North Country felt like a stranger. The lakes too cold, the woods too dark, the skies too gray. When I left, I prayed the same Sunday prayer before convoys, that an IED wouldn't wind up under our feet as we'd distract ourselves with fantasies about anything but battle. I thought it best to measure absence by how loud I groaned in joy at first sight of Superior. Her steel surface slid under my hands, rid a black grime from Iraq, where the sun illuminates a red history. It is there the threat of hot metal shards declared our moves. It is there the wind blew a silky dust over our battalion in 12-inch steps. We all saluted a pair of empty boots. It is there we found the heat of sun isn't a thing we cared to need. Like here, in the land of Superior, where I am sanctified in silence when fishing on ice, where a cold wind burns and turns my cheeks a purple shale, where waves lick the studded shores with stones aligned in copper constellations. It is here in spring when birds request the earth to dance. It is here in spring when I lie on the shores. I can hear it, the rattle, a piercing gargle, the wanting to return to that moment before it happened. Before the death became a part of breath, before the shores hummed a tainted tune of shells.
Alex Gubbins reading his poem In the Blood. This is Veterans Reflections on Public Radio 90.
If you love this land of the free,
bring 'em home, bring 'em home,
bring all truth.
Our thanks to Kaylin Bernard, Michael Brennan, Michael Greer, Gabe Waskowitz, Milton Bates, Tony Williams, Alan Lurst, and Alex Gubbins for sharing their work. Some of the stories in this program were edited for Time. Full versions are available on our website at wnmufm.org. Veterans Reflections is a production of Public Radio 90, WNMU. I'm Hans Ahlstrom.